This episode of the QTR Podcast is brought to you by VPN.com. Do you use Facebook, Instagram, or WhatsApp? More than 2 billion people do. Unfortunately, the recent Cambridge Analytica data scandal has brought many issues to light about how Facebook uses your data and informs you when an issue arises. Since 2014, more than 2 billion Facebook profiles like yours and mine were scraped by third parties without our permission on Facebook and then maliciously used against us. Thankfully, there are many efforts out here taking a stand for our privacy and how big companies respect our data. Organizations like VPN.com, that's VictorPaulNancy.com, have created campaigns entirely around the Delete Facebook hashtag to bring awareness to the reality of how our data is being used. In fact, they sent 6 huge hashtag Delete Facebook, one word, box trucks to the U.S. Capitol and Facebook headquarters, along with arranging multiple protests to advocate for more privacy and protection for consumers all across the world. To learn more about how to delete your Facebook or to keep up with the protests, visit VPN, that's Victor Paul Nancy, VPN.com/Facebook today. Okay, with that out of the way, I have to say, what's up, fools? This is the Quote the Raven podcast number 23, I believe. Today is April 23rd, 2018, and I am joined from a secret undisclosed location somewhere in Montana by...
High on a mountaintop.
By the very mysterious... And you even actually have, like, a very deep and mysterious voice also, too. You remind me of, like, Art Bell a little bit. You know who Art Bell was?
I know who Art Bell was, actually.
Yeah,
and I've been trying to emulate Rod Serling, but maybe I'm just at Art Bell stage.
I don't know. You have an Art Bell. Like, your voice would be great for a, like, 2 a.m. conspiracy theory terrestrial radio show like he did. But anyways,
an idea. Always good to have a diversified portfolio.
Anyways, I am here with Montana Skeptic. He is at Montana Skeptic 1 on Twitter. He is Montana Skeptic on Seeking Alpha, and he is the bane of many Tesla Long's existence. He has written, I was looking at your profile today, sir, something like 140 articles on Tesla and then one article on one other company. So I don't know what happened, if that was just a mistake, but you are definitely one of the most outspoken critics of Tesla. And so it is awesome to have you on. Tell us as much as you want to tell us about yourself and your background, and don't feel forced to tell us anything you don't want to.
Sure. I was trained as a lawyer. So I spent most of my career in commercial litigation and some of it involving securities litigation, a lot of it just people fighting about money, but mostly big dollar cases. And so I learned to read SEC filings. I learned to read tedious contracts. I learned to pay attention to tiny details, things that really make me terribly boring at parties, but are useful with Tesla because there are so many amazing things in its SEC filings and in the attachments to them. And I became interested in the company and started reading a little bit about it and started following it on Seeking Alpha and thought, well, I'll just try and write an article or two. And it sort of rolled along from there.
So I guess as a lawyer... I mean, having worked with a securities lawyer closely myself on more than one occasion, I think to some degree I understand exactly what you're talking about with paying attention to, you know, in documents that have 40,000 words in them, paying attention to the change of one adjective or the change of one word and how that can say something completely different. And I'm sure as an attorney, you understand that. What was it, using kind of your legal expertise, that first prompted you to look at Tesla? What was the first thing that caught your eye?
I wish I could remember exactly, but I had no negative feeling about Tesla when I started reading about it. There was somebody, after I stopped practicing law, I started working in finance. One of my former clients had a lot of money and said, just come manage my money, run my legal affairs. And so I began reading more about finance and more finance articles and started reading about this company, Tesla, and became fascinated with the idea. Somebody I knew said, oh, I'm going to go buy a Tesla Roadster. And I started reading the SEC filings, and then I started reading the Yahoo board on Tesla, which was interesting. There were some really interesting posters there who are now over at Seeking Alpha. And it reminded me so much of Enron in a lot of ways. And I think that triggered my fascination because I sort of knew a lot about Enron, had followed the Enron saga at the end closely. And, you know, with Enron, it was interesting. A lot of the problems with Enron were evident in the footnotes to the financial statements. And there were people who read them carefully and said, you know, this company is not what it appears to be. And I think Tesla is the same thing. I think all clues you need are there in the SEC filings.
And I think that's really well said, because for a long time I've kind of been championing the notion that for many of these companies, not only are the red flags hidden in plain sight, but really all you have to do is pick up a filing and read it. It's not, you know, 9 out of 10 times when short sellers go after companies in general, if you can go back and read, you know, the risk factors section of the 10K, or you can go and look at the financial statements, or you can read some of the language changes in an MD&A or something, everything is right there. The problem is that not everybody is looking at these filings at all, number one. Number two, the people that do read them tend to focus only on the financials and not so much on the qualitative side of things. And number three, I think many people that don't have a background in law and that aren't skeptics or cynics by nature don't really even know what to look for or what to look at critically. You know, it's all kind of just gobbledygook, which is why I like having people like you on the podcast, because what I'm trying to do is kind of let people know that this shit is buried in there. All you got to do is put the fucking work in and put some elbow grease in.
It's all there, but there's also one caution. We should start with this caution, because it may be that Tesla is really different from any other company. It may be different from a GoPro or from a Netflix or from some of these other high flyers that have come before, because there maybe, and I don't know for certain because I wasn't on the scene for GoPro, for example, and didn't read the message boards and see how intensely people felt. But with Tesla, it's a religion. For many people, they believe, and it combines a lot of threads of, you know, our modern intellectual landscape, because it's there's a hero, and everyone loves a hero, and you know he's a master engineer, even though he's not an engineer. He's a brilliant scientist, even though he has maybe a physics for poets understanding of physics. He's a technological whiz, even though he almost drove PayPal under and has incinerated more capital than anyone I can think of in modern times. But you have this, to them, he is a visionary hero. And it also, they're engaged in saving the earth from the evil fossil fuel people. And never mind where the electricity comes from. They're convinced that Tesla with these 3-ton cars is going to save the earth. And it's a substitute for having to think rigorously. And there is that religious element is so powerful with Tesla that it's hard to know when the real fundamentals will matter. I call it fundamentalism versus fundamentals. So maybe Tesla is a little different like that. So anyway, that's just to preface everything else we say.
Sure.
Because there are days I scratch my head and I say, why is this company so impervious to bad news?
Well, there's one reason and one reason alone. And I actually started a draft of an article very, very early this morning that will probably be on Seeking Alpha over the next day or two. But what it talks about is exactly what you're trying to address, which is what causes a company to command a $50 or $47 billion valuation that has negative operating leverage, no equity to fall back on, and no net income to give it value? So it's a $47 billion cream puff that just kind of continues to get bigger. But you're 100% right in saying that, you know, this is, it's a religion for a lot of people. It's a confidence game, And there's a lot of people that don't understand. I mean, I think part of the problem is people are just misinformed about the public markets in general. I think if you went up to 9 out of 10 people on the street right now who are, you know, buyers of Elon Musk's book at Barnes & Noble, they wouldn't be able to tell you that the company isn't even profitable.
Yeah, they wouldn't know. Most, if you talk to most people on the street, they think Tesla must be a wildly profitable company. I mean, I really think that's true.
So I think at the... go ahead.
No. Just reading the comments at the financial site, it's astonishing how many people who comment on Tesla at Seeking Alpha, right, a financial site, have no idea that capital expenditures aren't part of the income statement. You know, Tesla spent all its profit on capital expenditures. I've read that so many times, I can't tell you. So there's just enormous innumeracy. Maybe it's willful. Maybe it just doesn't matter to them, because when it's pointed out, it doesn't change their belief one iota. You know, this is kind of like the way our cognitive biases work.
Well, or they don't have the capacity to understand it, really. I mean, it's...
Yeah, or the willingness. Surely they have the capacity, but they have no desire to. I think we look for things, you know, this is old Daniel Kahneman school of thought, but we really want to confirm our biases first and foremost, and we'll tune out stuff that's inconvenient.
Sure, and I think it helps if you're... I think it helps if you don't really have an understanding of how the capital markets work either.
Yeah. Well, surprisingly few people do, right?
Yes, and that is one of the things that has always kind of pushed me to talk more about it. And I've said in articles that I've written and on the podcast and pretty much everywhere that if everybody understood how the capital markets worked and they weren't kind of clouded in this jargon, and you could say the same thing about the economy, that there would be fucking riots.
So let's talk about... let's talk about the Q1 financials that are coming out in 10 days or so. What, after Tesla publishes them with its quarterly update newsletter that'll pick out every possible metric that it can use that is positive and will cease using the ones that are no longer convenient, will they say exactly how many Model 3 reservations they have? Will they say... you know, what they're seeing by way of a take rate from the people who've been offered the car? And if they don't, will the analysts ask them about that on the conference call? And if they don't answer, will the analysts bore in and follow up? I'll be curious, because it seems to me the one thing that I think does cause the story to unravel quickly is if there's a perception that Model 3 demand is cratering. That's what Tesla has to really fear right now. And they're going to do everything they can to keep the story alive till they can get the Model Y out there and get a capital raise out there. Because unless they do that, they're done. So that's kind of what I'm looking for in Q1. The margins are going to be hideously bad. And Tesla knows it. They're going to be, you know, just well below what Tesla is saying they're going to be. And as said, its aspirational margin is for the Model 3. So you're going to see a gross margin of maybe 13%, and those are on the high-margin cars. Right now, Tesla's selling all these high-margin Model 3s. There's a limited pool of people who want to buy those.
Right.
And once it uses those up, then it's got to – is it really ever going to offer the shorter-range model for $35,000?
Right.
It will get crucified if it does. It knows it loses an unbearable amount of money on every one of those, even if they add $5,000 of options. So it's running out of rope. It's running out of time, I think. Can they get to Q4 without having to drop the price on the Model 3 and go to those lower price versions? I just don't think there's enough demand in the U.S., or Canada, if that's where they want to divert some, if they're going to play the game, which we can talk about, of reaching 200,000 early in Q3. And then it all falls apart. They have got to get that capital raise out the door in early Q4.
So Let's talk about how they're going to raise capital and when they're going to do it. I think we're probably both we both probably think that it has to happen. And talk to me about how you think the capital raise is going to happen versus what Elon Musk has recently commented, which is that they won't need to raise capital this year. And
he said they weren't required to, but clearly they are going to do it. Let's kind of back up a bit. I want to talk about the capital raise. I had thought sure Tesla would hit 200,000, and this 200,000 U.S. cars that are qualified deliveries is an important number, as you know, right? Once you hit it, then the buyers of your cars get the full $7,500 federal income tax credit during the quarter that you hit it. And they get it for the entire quarter after you hit it. If Tesla hit it in Q2, then, like, if it hit it tomorrow, well, then it would only get another month and a half here in Q2, and it would get all of Q3. So what it looked to me like they would be certain to hit it this quarter, because they're about, though Tesla never publicizes the number, right, which you'd think is material, they were probably close to 177,000, 178,000 at the end of Q1. So that left them 22,000 more in this quarter. You would have thought with the Model 3 and the S and X, they would hit it. But now the Tesla bots are all saying, no, Elon is so brilliant, he's going to ship cars to Canada or ship them overseas so that he can avoid hitting it. And he'll hit it on the first day of Q3. And maybe Tesla's going to try to do that. That will just make Q2 an even bigger disaster than Q1. But if you wanted to do the capital raise, what you would do is you would load up Q1 and Q2 with terrible stuff. You would hoard all of your ZEV credits and not sell them until Q3, because they don't become revenue until you sell them. They don't appear anywhere, not on the balance sheet. There's nowhere you even know how many Tesla has. And you would do everything you can possibly to juice it so that Q3 is the best number possible. And in conjunction with a Model Y reveal, you would then try to get out the door with a capital raise. I think that's got to be the plan.
So talk to me about whether or not you think the market is going to continue to buy this, because the way that the tape has been here over the last 3 weeks or month has been, it looked as though, this 300 level on the stock was going to give out on more than one occasion. And each time, Elon came out with something. First it was 6,000, or sorry, first it was, we're not going to do a capital raise. Then it was cash flow positive Q3, Q4. And then it was, we're going to be producing 6,000, cars. The 6,000 cars per week target over the summer. So each time that's happened, the stock has kind of gotten a little bit of a boost. But now the tape looks kind of ugly. It doesn't look like it's going to reclaim that $300 level. And I'm interested in what you think as to what is the market's perception here. Do you think people are starting to kind of see through all of this fluff and really? Do you think the market is starting to demand results and not just promises at this point?
I'm going to refuse to answer that. I have no idea. If the market was seeing through it, the price should be $28 and not $280 today. Okay, $280 is an insane price for Tesla. It's insane. What Musk said, by the way, is, he had said we're going to be positive operating cash flow, I think is what they said, for Q3. Now, in his crazy tweet, when he got mad at The Economist for quoting somebody else, Jeffries, I guess.
Yeah, it was Jeffries.
We're gonna be profitable in Q3 and Q4. Well, that's nuts. There's no way Tesla is going to be profitable, even by a non-GAAP metric, in Q3 or Q4. They might, if they engineer everything, be able to do a one-time positive operating cash flow, like they, how they engineered things back in 2016 when they had their famous pie in the face quarter.
It was core. I think the metric that they used was core operating cash flow or some shit I have never heard of before. That's what you're referring to, right?
Well, they actually were. They actually showed a profit. Okay, by loading up on ZEV credits, by loading up on regulatory credits, they showed a tiny profit in Q3 2016. So it was more than just that weird core metric they used another time. But I don't think they can do that again this year. I don't think they can, even with all the tricks, I don't think they can show a profit. It was a non-GAAP profit, but even at that. But they can possibly show some operating cash flow. And a guy named Bill Cunningham at Seeking Alpha wrote a great article about all the different levers Tesla can pull to generate more cash and hang on this year. It's really a great piece. It just went up a few days ago, so you can still catch it there.
That's what I was going to ask you about. What can they gear to do that? What can they kind of curb spending on, and what can they temporarily hold off on? I mean, just these last couple of headlines over the last week or two that are giving me the indication that they're starting to cut corners, like when they are taking amenities off of their pre-owned certification program that they're doing. They're not cosmetically fixing any of the pre-owned vehicles. A bunch of Model S's, I guess, were on 3-year leases and are all coming back, and they're getting ready to resell those as certified pre-owned cars. What they used to do is they used to do a operational and mechanical inspection, and they would also do a cosmetic evaluation, I guess, would fix dents and shit like that. And now they've come out and said, well, we're not going to do the cosmetic end of that anymore. And it just, I'm wondering what kind of corners can they cut? Do you think that's what's going on?
That was a surprise. Also, you know, if you look at their leasing history, the it's just now starting to ramp up with the lease returns. You're going to see that it really ramp up as this year progresses and going into next year, because in 2016 they did a bunch of those 2-year leases too, starting in the third quarter, and those things were very aggressive the way that they price those leases and the residuals. So a lot of those cars are going to come bouncing back, and Tesla's going to have a lot of used cars on its hands. I think it must just be too overwhelmed to I don't think it's a cost issue. They must be too overwhelmed to be refurbishing the cars like they ought to, so that they could get a better price on reselling them. And, you know, a guy named Hunevold, do you follow him on Twitter? Bozy is his first name. He noted that Tesla now has a record number of cars that they've put into auction at Mannheim. So they're starting to use auctions more, which is really going to depress the price of their used cars, I think.
But sure.
I think that was inevitable. Can they cut CapEx? Sure. I don't know how easy it is to cut CapEx in the auto industry, because you have to do a lot of forward planning on CapEx. So if they've really budgeted for $3.5 million, which is what they said for this year, can they cut it more than 10% really without breaking some contracts and creating real problems? Maybe. What does that do to the Model Y story?
Right.
What does that do to the Semi story, the Roadster story?
I mean,
I don't know.
Lest we forget that they're going to need, you know, there's going to be a significant amount of CapEx involved with getting those off the ground, right?
Well, you would think so. Like, don't we need a factory somewhere? It's amazing what people believe. You know, the things people believe are simply stunning about that. And if they engineer this great quarter, let's say they even engineered a profitable quarter in Q3, who is dumb enough to believe that it's anything more than a one-time trick? You can do it once, and by then you've run out of all your high-margin Model 3s. You know, there will be a big demand for Teslas in Q3 and Q4 if that's when they hit 200,000, because everyone will say, okay, last chance to get the full federal income tax credit. After 2018, it shrinks to $3,750 for the first half of 2019. Then it goes to $1,875 for the second half, and then it's gone. So everybody's going to want to pile in and get that full tax credit. And so that's the time to do it. But once that's gone, and once you're out of high margin buyers of the Model 3, and if all you've been able to do is eke out a tiny profit, if you're that lucky,
right?
Who believes this story has any gas? You just have to be naive to believe it.
Well, that's how the Model 3 story was sold. right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it was sold to the market. They're going to be making an everyday car, a $35,000 car and they'll make it up in volume.
Well, it was sold as a $35,000 car, and that really is almost fraudulent. There is no $35,000 car, and Tesla knows it will go broke if it sells more than it might make a few hundred to say, there, you see, we sold the $35,000 car. And then the story will be, but not enough people really wanted it at that, so we raised the price. I mean, this Model 3, it's just a catastrophe. There's no way out of this box that they're in. The car costs too much to build. I wish they would ramp up to 5,000 a week now, because the sooner they do, the sooner it's clear that for a car costing $50,000, there's a tiny market. And for Tesla to sell it for much less than that, it takes a huge bath. And once those become apparent, then the story has to be, well, the Model Y. Well, how long is it going to be before we see a Model Y? And by the time the Model Y gets here, there's 20 other EVs that are reliable and inexpensive compared to Tesla. And, and not to mention the fact that you have, in Europe, you have a new charging standard that is going to have advantages. And in China, you have a charging standard that's different from what Tesla has. So their moat is, and in the United States, you have Electrify America putting up all these charging stations. You tell me, how long can they keep this alive? No, clearly so far fundamentals haven't mattered. Will they start mattering? What about this latest price action? I don't know. We've seen it before. Remember, Tesla dropped into the 100s a couple of years ago. I mean, it was down to 140 or something.
It's a question of how long they can kick the can down the road. And in this market, you know, I'm not surprised that the company has the value that it does, because, you know, we operate in an economy that encourages deficit spending, that is more about, you know, spending than it is savings. It's more about consuming than it is under consuming. The debt markets, the cost of capital has been so cheap due to interest rates being at zero that we have all of these bubbles and so many, you know, there isn't a corporation out there that's not carrying a load of debt right now because it is so cheap to take on. And I think overall, the market has a very lax mindset about, you know, what a company needs to have and what it doesn't need to have. And I wouldn't be surprised if Tesla I'm surprised that they've made it this far. I was just looking at Adam Jonas's price targets over the course of the last, I think, 3 or 4 years. And he had an EPS target for 2018, I believe, several years ago that was like $2.30 per share. And that has now obviously come down to a loss of $6.50 per share or something like that. And his price target on the stock has stayed the same. it's an enormous swing in how much net income the company is going to generate, but it doesn't affect his price target. And I think that's...
No, he was just out last week with another update, and he lowered his EPS estimate, but he kept his price target the same, which includes, you know, like $103 for Tesla Mobility or something ridiculous like that. But otherwise, it's $273 a share, which I think is Adam Jonas saying, you know, the tone of his notes to me has changed a lot. He's become a lot more negative. But this Tesla Mobility stuff, he's still holding on to that. I think he may be the last person that believes it.
There was an interesting article out, I think, last week also, too, that was asking, you know, will the government bail out Tesla? And I was like, whoa, like, talk about a change in mainstream media narrative, except it's gone.
Yeah, no, that was Morgan Stanley.
Was it?
Adam Jonas asked, I actually wrote an article at Seeking Alpha about this. Adam Jonas said, you know, we need to consider whether Tesla is too big to fail. They've got 30-some-odd thousand employees, 35,000-plus employees, and it's an important American car, and maybe it's just too big to fail, which is like saying, talk about a bearish thing to say. I was astonished that he went there, but he did go there. So
it's an absolutely insane thing to say. It's going from being blindingly positive about the company and not giving a fuck about the fundamentals, all the way swinging to the other side of the pendulum, going all the way through the area where you would be skeptical and kind of say, all right, it's an overvalued company and the stock is ridiculously priced and it has to come down. It goes all the way past all that and just says, well, maybe it's too big to fail. And it's like, is that the long thesis now? Like, what is that?
Yeah, you wonder. Jonas is a really weird character to me. In some ways, he's very astute. He called what the Model 3 delivery number would be in Q1, almost precisely on it. And I think his numbers about what the deliveries are going to be for the Model 3 are probably as good as anybody's out there right now. And they're bearish, but he was spot on. And on the other hand, he spouts this nonsense about Tesla Mobility as a big component of the value of the company. He's constantly had to slash his EPS forecast, but his price target has remained bulletproof. It's just the people who follow him and pay attention to him have to read the body language that he's giving them to know what to do. And right now his body language is saying, sell this crap, you know. But until some of these big institutional investors decide they have to sell it, either because the macro environment changes or because one or two of them says, you know, we need to get the hell out of here. And that starts. It's hard to know when the price breaks down.
Well, a really large portion of their outstanding shares are held by like five institutions, right?
Yeah, they are. I think Baillie Gifford is one of them. Fidelity is another. They're huge holders of the shares.
They're in somewhat of a prisoner's dilemma, you could argue. Nobody wants to be the first one to jump off the raft.
And, you know, who knows who's selling, who's buying and who's selling today? We just don't know. The float is not that big, in, relatively speaking, in Tesla. So it may be a lot of momentum traders trading this stuff back and forth. I don't know. On any given day, you just don't know who's really buying and who's selling. What happens when Ron Barron's investors take a look at their monthly statement? Do they, you know, say, hey, get me out of here? Is he forced to sell down? I don't think there are that many ETFs, you know, index ETFs that own Tesla. That would change, of course, if it became part of the S&P 500, but it's not.
So let me ask you a question. I have a couple questions I want to ask you. The first is, you know, as somebody with experience in litigation and, you know, as a lawyer by trade, talk to me about one of the issues that I raised on my podcast a couple of weeks ago is, when is enough going to be enough in terms of what Elon has said publicly, how he's disclosed it, and these targets that he's consistently missed, whether it's production targets, whether it's saying they're going to be profitable and not being profitable. Talk to me about what the real liability there could be, because to me it just seems as though, I feel like if they miss these targets that he said about profitability for Q3 and Q4, and if they raise capital in 2018 and they don't hit this 6,000 per week goal, I feel like the onus would be on the regulators to step in there, because I just feel like it's egregious at that point. Talk to me from a lawyer's standpoint about Musk's disclosures and how he makes them, and what do you think?
Sure. Well, okay, this is completely speculative on my part, because we don't know what anybody's thinking or doing.
Sure.
I don't think it's the SEC that's going to shut Tesla down. It's going to have to be a private lawsuit that does it first. The SEC is not going to want to be in the position of coming and causing or being accused of causing this company to collapse.
Right.
There are a lot of people who speculate they can't raise money right now. And let me tell you, I'm astonished that they didn't do it when the price was in the 350s last year. I thought sure they would go to the equity markets. I was surprised when they borrowed money instead.
Wasn't that nuts? The stock was at 360. It was at all-time highs.
I thought that was crazy. I really thought that was crazy. And now those notes, which I think went out at 5.3%, and that they were oversubscribed, Tesla said, oh, good, we'll borrow another $300 million on top of the $1.5 billion. I think the latest yield on those is above 7%.
Yeah, it's
so
seven,
those guys have gotten hammered.
It's about 7.2%, I think, right now.
And by the way, those notes were issued at a time when Musk was making confident statements about how the Model 3 production was coming along just swimmingly, right? Those bondholders really were sold a bill of goods. But a big problem that a lot of the class action lawyers, it seems to me, have had is damages. What are their damages? Yes, for example, the SolarCity merger, terrible breach of fiduciary duty, and yet the price of Tesla rose after the merger, right? So how are you damaged? That's a real problem. And until there's price erosion, those suits don't start to really tell against Tesla. This latest class action is much more intelligent. It would be class action in California, where they appointed the lead counsel and he amended his complaint recently and has a class that's pretty narrowly defined for 10 or 11 months of purchasing. But it won't be the SEC, I don't think. I don't think you can't expect some deus ex machina to come and shut Tesla down. It's going to have to be the markets that do it. They're going to have to say, we've had enough. There are lawsuits that clearly have merit. For example, all these people buying full self-driving promises, right? They have a great claim against Tesla. They were promises 2 years ago. Their cars have now depreciated, or their leases are 50% over or more, and they don't have the capabilities they were promised. They have got very meritorious lawsuits. They're not huge damage amounts, unless you can say, well, I never would have bought the car at all but for this promise. But those lawsuits take a long time to get through discovery and motion practice and everything else. It's a year or two down the road before that finally happens. I don't see litigation. I see litigation as something that happens to Elon Musk after the company fails, but it's not going to cause it to fail.
Yeah, you see it as kind of a Madoff scenario where the SEC steps in after the thing's already fallen apart.
Yeah, I think so. Well, listen, and let me... A lot of people are critical of the SEC about Tesla. The SEC has been on Tesla. There's a lot of correspondence with Tesla, and Tesla has had to change the way it reports its non-GAAP and GAAP items. It's had to increase its detail on supercharger accounting and other issues. The SEC has really been on top of them, but the SEC cannot be everywhere. You know, we all are obsessed with
sure.
Tesla. There's a lot of people, there's hundreds and hundreds of corporations doing sleazy things that the SEC has to keep an eye on. And I think they're doing what they can with Tesla, and we shouldn't hold it against the SEC that they haven't shut Tesla down. That's just...
No, I wasn't suggesting that, but, you know, here's something that I wrote in my forthcoming article that I'll ask you about. The latest class action lawsuit, the one that alleges basically that Musk knew that Model 3 production was not going swimmingly in 2017 and he made a bunch of statements to the contrary, in fact, that he was informed by the CFO, the then CFO at the time, that, you know, the targets that he had set publicly were difficult and they weren't going to be met, yet he didn't disclose otherwise or he didn't change his tone. Those kind of... to me, go hand in hand with what Probes Reporter had talked about when they talked about an open and closed. Apparently, there was an undisclosed SEC investigation into the company 2015 to 2017 or 2016 to 2017. And this is all as reported by Probes Reporter on Seeking Alpha. But they stated that one of the SEC's inquiries at the time, I think in 2017, was with regard to Model 3 production, Model 3 targets, you know, all of these key little data points relating to the Model 3. I thought it was interesting that that's the type of stuff that came up in this private litigation. Does that mean anything to you?
Well, I think, first of all, that amended complaint in the private litigation is a must read for anybody who owns Tesla shares. It's really brilliantly written, and it assembles the material, and it's frightening to see the reckless things that that Musk said and did, if everything in it is true. And I don't doubt
alleged,
that
right.
Okay, but they have 11 witnesses who they interviewed that are former employees, and they have a great deal of very precise factual detail. I think it's a terrific piece of work, and I think it's a great fraud case, and I think it has legs. And I think eventually they'll be able to get their class certified, if I had to guess. And I think they've got a capable counsel heading it up. I've never met the guy, but the complaint was so artfully prepared, and there'd been so much work put into it that it's clear he knows what he's about. And I've read about Probe's reporter says there's an ongoing investigation. And some people say, well, that must be why Tesla hasn't raised capital. And, you know, those bonds that they went out with last year, they were done with an exemption, right? So under, what is it, Rule 144. And they did that deal with Grohmann where they gave Grohmann stock again under an exemption. Maybe Tesla can't. Maybe they really have some impediment on a capital raise. And maybe it's a Musk bluff when he says we're not required to raise capital. He's beating his chest and saying we don't even need to do it. I don't know. I just have a hard time believing that's the case. I think we would have seen something from Pricewaterhouse because, you know, on their going concern, that would be a real going concern issue if that were the case.
Sure. So just run it back to what we were talking about before, which is them choosing to tap the debt market instead of issuing equity at all-time highs. You know, the company, I think, was valued at something like $60 billion when they went and raised debt instead of issuing equity. And, you know, the bonds that they issued, I think, were junk-rated bonds when they issued them.
Right.
They've dropped in value now. Like I said, I think the yield on that paper is 7.2% today, I think it was. I've just found that fascinating to begin with. Do you think, I mean, I'm only asking this because some of the sell side coverage on the company has gotten negative, like Goldman, who was integral in helping them raise capital by issuing equity and was always a cheerleader for the stock. Even that one time they upgraded them, I think the day before a capital raise, or they upgraded them the day after capital. It was something egregious and ridiculous. But do you think that banks have kind of stepped away and they won't even, I find it hard to believe that banks wouldn't help them issue equity and just take their chunk from it.
Yeah. Well, of course, I'm speculating here. I think Goldman has definitely cooled on Tesla and would be loath to have something go out at the price we see now, even at 280. That's probably too rich. They may be telling Tesla, we can't peddle this stuff at that price. There's the institutions who are going to need to sign on to take more of this stuff don't want to share average at 280. They'd be much more comfortable closer to 200 or whatever they're being told. So clearly Goldman has cooled a lot. And if you read the body language, Morgan Stanley has cooled a lot. They've been two big underwriters for Tesla. But there's always more that'll do it. You know, you have the Ben Callows of the world and his shop who would be happy to. There's always underwriters you can find to go peddle this stuff. I just think it would be a little bit bearish for Tesla to not be able to involve either Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs. I think it's got to be equity this time. I think they're tapped out on debt. For one thing, the debt markets have wised up. And, you know, you see that with the yields now that are being demanded on the 5.3 bonds. And you see that with the coupon, the convertibles, too. You've seen the yields really shrink there, even with the optionality. And I think they're getting close to tapped out under their asset-backed loan agreement, the secured revolving line they have. There are limitations on how much other debt they can have. And boy, I have to believe the banks involved in that are getting nervous, especially with all the Model 3 problems. That is a very generous secured line. They get credit for like 85% of inventory and 85% of equipment. Those are high percentages to give somebody as a borrowing base.
Sure.
Figure. And, you know, you've got 8 or 9 different big banks involved in that and Deutsche Bank running the show. And I have to believe.
Appropriately so.
Yeah. So I think they're close to tapped out on debt. Debt would be too expensive for them to do. It's going to have to be equity, and that'll be just fun to watch. right now, if they could issue equity at 250, it would be a home run for Tesla.
Right. Yep.
If they can issue equity at 200, it's a home run. If this company can issue equity at 100, it's a home run, because it's not worth anything close to those values.
Right.
So doing any of that is in my opinion, a brilliant thing for Tesla to do.
And get as much as you can. I mean, like you're saying, no matter how they do it, no matter how they raise capital, whether it's they do it through this taking on reservations for a new model, which has its downside because it's going to really start to look stinky, or if they try to issue debt, you know, that, like you're saying, the bond market's telling us that their paper should yield over 7%. So it's going to be on much more. The screws will have tightened significantly on the terms on their debt. So it's really going to put it to them. I think you're right when you say it has to be equity. And I think that we could see a deal done here on terms that start a conversation about toxic, you know, death spiral financing. And I'm not saying they're going to go into a death spiral, but I think the first time they have to issue equity at a relatively significant discount in order to make sure that there's demand, and whether it's, you know, whether there's some other type of derivative or something involved remains to be seen. But I think that starts a whole other conversation that I think.
So, and what's your next story too? Your story? Well, we had Tesla Energy. Remember how Tesla Energy by this year was going to have at least $3 billion to $5 billion in revenues with margins at 15% and climbing. Well, that certainly didn't happen. Model X was going to outsell the Model S, and it was going to be profitable. It didn't do either of those things. We had Tesla solar roof tiles. This was going to be a tremendous product, and if their demand was off the wall for this, it was off the wall for the Powerwall. None of that has happened, and now we're going to make a mass market car, this beautiful Model 3, 35,000. 400,000 people line up and put down their reservations, and they don't have a $35,000 car, and there's no indication when they will get it. And frankly, I think they'll never get it. And so you're going to go tell them, oh, here's this beautiful Model Y, and we'll have it made in 2 years, even though every other car maker takes at least 3 years to just design and build the factory, never mind test the car. And by that time, we'll be crawling with competition. And all you suckers who have reservations outstanding hoping for your $35,000 car with the federal income tax credit, well, gee, we're really sorry about that, but come put a reservation down on the Model Y instead. I think it's a harder story to sell this time. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this guy can just sell this stuff forever. But I think, what are the investors going to say? Now we know 2018 is going to be a catastrophe. I think you're looking at close to $3 billion in gap losses this year. 2019 is going to be worse. The federal income tax credit will be shrunk to half and then a quarter in 2019. The competition will be hitting in a big way. At the high end, you've got the Jag and the Audi and Mercedes coming out with its cars. And at the lower end, you've got the Hyundai Kona, which, by the way, is a good-looking car, and the Niro, its sort of sister car. Tesla's going to get its lunch eaten in 2019. And there's no hope of having the Model Y in any kind of volume until when? 2020, maybe? 2021, more likely? So the company's going to endure, what, another $10 billion in losses before it ever gets there? And then you finally have to say to yourself, well, what about valuation? How much money does this company have to earn to be worth $200 a share or $100 a share? Once people start asking that question,
right?
You know, we're not talking about the dividend aristocrats here.
And forget about the mindset of investors. What's the mindset of somebody who's put down a reservation on a Model 3, and their cash is gone, and the company isn't even producing? I mean, what are you thinking if you're in early, you know? And I've seen these people on like the Tesla Motor Club's forum and on various message boards, you know, hey, I'm waiting for my car. Even Elon Musk had a conversation with one guy, I think, on Twitter, where he's like, where's my car? And he's like, it's going to be at least another 3 or 6 months or something. Like, what do you feel like if you're somebody that put down a reservation on a Model 3 and the company can't even produce the vehicle? I mean, what's that going to do to future demand? What's it going to do to current demand? What type of liability does that expose the company to?
I have to believe that a lot of the people who hold these Model 3 reservations are becoming disillusioned. And the name of the game for Tesla is to keep hope alive right now, because it cannot allow an erosion to become public, an erosion in the number of these reservations. Now, can those reservations can be gamed? You know, some big investor could easily snap up 10,000, 20,000 reservations. It's worth it just to prop up the stock price. Who knows what kind of monkey business goes on? It's impossible to police that kind of stuff until it's too late. But keeping the Model 3 reservation story alive is crucial to Tesla. The entire story of the company right now is built on the idea that 400,000 people lined up for a reservation on this car. It's the most unprecedented demand in the history of consumer markets throughout the entire universe and every parallel universe. And that's the story.
So do you think eventually, to me, it seems like Musk is spending a lot of time on his other projects. And what I want to ask you is it me, or do you feel like he's also spending more time with the Boring Company, with SpaceX, with all this other shit he's got going on, with, you know, everything, with Instagram, all the things I wouldn't be doing if I was CEO of Tesla? You think his attention is divided up too thin, is spread too thin, number one? And number two, you think he'll ultimately step back as CEO of Tesla? And I mean, Jim Chanos keeps saying he thinks Musk is going to step back and that he'll remain chairman of the board. What does that situation look like to you in your head? What do you think?
Getting inside Elon Musk's head is impossible. To me, and this is just a personal prejudice I have, it has nothing to do with my thesis, my negative thesis on Tesla, but I think the guy is mentally unbalanced. I think he's a narcissist. He's an egomaniac. He is a pretender. And some of these tweets lately have been completely unhinged.
Right.
They have been in any company with any kind of responsible corporate governance, with a board of directors that's half awake, with a general counsel who is capable and not the former divorce counsel, this stuff would not be allowed to happen.
Right.
They're violations of the fair disclosure regulations. They are making absurd and crazy promises. And I just think he's an unbalanced guy under a lot of stress. And I think eventually he'll step back from Tesla and just hope he doesn't get sued too many times by too many people, and try and cut a deal with whoever holds his stock so that the reorganized company takes him back. I think Tesla is nothing without Elon Musk. He needs to continue to have some kind of role for the brand to have any value.
So do you think that this new pay plan that they've offered him, you know, a couple weeks ago on my podcast, I basically said this pay plan is an insult to people's intelligence, because it doesn't really, you know, he can trigger a lot of these milestones by things that don't have anything to do with profitability or with.
No, I love your podcast on that. I completely agree with everything you said on that podcast. Talk about an irresponsible. What kind of board of directors would ever sponsor a pay plan that encourages this guy to just keep pumping up the stock without any regard to profitability? It's corporate governance at its absolute worst. Really, I mean, really, the board of directors ought to be ashamed of themselves at Tesla. Tesla, by the way, self-insures on many things, but it buys D&O insurance, and it's a good thing because these people, they're ripe targets for tremendous fiduciary duty lawsuits when this thing falls apart.
Right.
Because they have been asleep at the wheel. They have just sucked up to Musk, and these new directors are worse than the old ones. It's a terrible story.
Well, my contention was that because the pay plan was so stupid, and because it was such, you know, it's really ridiculous, okay, to offer somebody an incentive based on market cap. Anybody that, you know, is in control of a publicly controlled company can go out and issue stock and just generate market cap out of nowhere. It doesn't have to be in the best interest of shareholders. So there's an enormous conflict of interest there, number one. I think it's a ridiculous thing to do in general, number two, without, you know, any other types of conditions. But do you think that they offered him this pay plan because it is just so, I mean, I think they did it because it is just so crucial. It is so absolutely instrumental for him to stay there that this may have been, you know, one way they felt like they could lock him up. Because like you said, without the Elon Musk call option, I mean, if Mary Barra is running this company and it's putting up the numbers that it's putting up, I mean, it's a zero overnight, right? So without the Elon Musk call option, the stock is screwed. Do you think that
it may be?
You think the pay plan was just to keep him there?
You know, but the trouble is, when Tesla goes to hell, what is SpaceX worth? Who knows what it's worth right now? But a lot of the magic of Elon Musk is gone when Tesla goes to hell. What is the Boring Company? Who's going to believe? Why should states or counties or cities that are already flat broke and have massive unfunded pension liabilities go issue billions more in bonds to pay for a tunnel for Elon Musk? After this guy has had, I don't know, $6-7 billion, when you add up all the subsidies at Tesla and still going broke, I think it's Tesla or bust for Elon Musk. I don't see how he escapes a lot of reputational harm once Tesla goes under. And in fact, that is the justification for the SolarCity merger. It was nobody ever believed this bullshit about synergies. Everybody knew that was a lot of hogwash. The justification for doing it was, if SolarCity goes under, it tarnishes our hero, Elon Musk, and we cannot have the tarnish. We must allow the Reeve brothers and their cousin Elon to make a silent liquidation of SolarCity and to get the money back to SpaceX, and we'll do all this under the cover of Tesla. And because we can't, if the reputational harm would have been too great for Tesla, it would have damaged the brand. I mean, I think that's the best justification you can make for the SolarCity acquisition. And, people have second acts and third acts all the time, I guess. But if Tesla goes under, it seems to me Musk is damaged goods.
Yeah, it really does feel like his namesake. It feels like this is his flagship project. I mean, people don't even know that he was involved in PayPal. People don't know about his past. People don't know
he stole the company from Martin Eberhard, basically. I mean, he forced Eberhard out. Eberhard had a lot of great ideas, and I think Tesla originally was going to be doing hybrids, which, by the way, if you're an environmentalist, make a hell of a lot more sense than hauling around 2 tons of batteries all over the place with, you know, rare earth minerals in them. But anyway, I guess I disagree with Jim Chanos, even though he's a brilliant guy. I'm not sure that maybe Musk would like a way out, but I don't see any easy way out for him.
So I just have like two more questions here I want to ask you. You have a little bit of time yet?
Let's go.
Okay, let's go. What do you think about all of these executive departures that have taken place over the last 7 or 8 years? There's been, looks like upwards of 50 of them. These are the high level people too. So the ones that we know about, we're not talking about people on the floor that come and go, but VPs, directors, officers, seems to be a revolving door.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, some of it's inevitable in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, maybe more in Silicon Valley, but
sure.
No, this is an extraordinary level. So what do I don't know any of them personally, but it's a huge red flag, right? Anybody who does not regard it as a red flag is just kidding themselves. This guy has a hard time attracting loyal, capable people. I think he wants nothing but yes men. He's always looking for people to blame. It's got to be awfully difficult to work for him. He knows best. I have wondered how frustrating it must be to be Peter Hochholdinger, who, as you know, came there from Audi to help with their manufacturing processes. And I'm sure that his advice has been roundly disregarded, or you never would have rolled out the Model 3 with no beta testing and no, you know, production part validation and all the stuff you usually do. But yeah, so I would say it's a big red flag.
And I guess my next question is, you said at the very beginning of the podcast that you see a lot of similarities with Enron, and I wanted to just, well, first, I kind of wanted to ask you about where you were when the whole Enron thing happened and whether or not it was something you followed super closely, whether you were invested, how close you were to it, and then kind of circle the square and let me know what some of the same things are that you're seeing.
Well, I knew a lot of people at Enron, and I knew a lot of lawyers who represented Enron. And in fact, when Enron went bankrupt because I didn't have any conflict of interest, had not represented the company before, I was hired in the bankruptcy to help out with the bankruptcy. I was not the lead counsel was Weil Gotshal, but I had a part in it. So I learned a lot more about Enron then. And I remember it was like a mania that swept Texas with Enron, where people were buying up the stock and were convinced that the people running the company just had vision and were great geniuses. And, you know, the conference calls became celebrated with Skilling and his performances. And also I remember the looking at their Q's and K's and thinking, because I had actually a client who was a vendor to Enron and was concerned about it. And I had to look at them and I thought, ooh, this is trouble. And, you know, but it was apparent in the filings that they were in trouble, even when the stock price was soaring. And I know you look at Tesla charts from time to time. I did. He has a chart showing the price decline at Enron. It took a long time for Enron for the air to go out of the tire there, even after all the bad news started coming in. And maybe that's what we're seeing with Tesla right now. It's going to take longer than we think, but the bad news is there and it's being processed.
What did you notice? What did you notice in Enron's filings?
Okay, so a lot of, you know, Enron used a lot of special purpose entities to hide a lot of its liabilities.
Right.
And that stuff was disclosed in footnotes to the, I always thought that the best defense that Arthur Andersen has was that it was all there in the footnotes if you read them, you know, and not that we were misled.
Right.
But, you know, they use special purpose entities all over the place. And if you read Tesla's footnotes carefully, there's a lot of problems are disclosed in the footnotes. Obviously, SolarCity is fond of the special purpose entities. And I don't think they're as problematic as they were at Enron. But all the problems with, for example, the contractual obligations, Tesla has, what, 20-some-odd million, a billion, excuse me, dollars of contractual obligations over the next several years. A lot of those are owed to Panasonic. The agreements with Panasonic, even though they're heavily redacted, they're right there to read. And what you see is an iterative process. Tesla says to Panasonic, hey, we're going to make 200,000 Model 3s this year, and we're going to need batteries, cells for them. And so Panasonic says, okay, well, I have to go buy this equipment. Do you approve this equipment? And if Tesla says, yes, we approve, Panasonic can go buy it, and Tesla becomes obligated to buy those cells and to pay for them enough to pay for the materials plus a return on investment of that equipment. That's a huge obligation that Tesla's undertaken. And Tesla's obviously not producing the Model 3s it thought it was going to. But Panasonic is sitting there with all that equipment. There has to be a really interesting dynamic right now between Tesla and Panasonic. I wonder what the discussions are in Japan and how much Tesla owes Panasonic. But all that's disclosed, and it's a huge problem sitting there. In New York, Tesla is obligated to pay the state of New York, I forget the exact number, it's $50 million or something a year for every year they fail to meet their obligations up here, going back to the SolarCity days. Well, that obligation's going to start soon. I think it has to start next year at the latest. That's, you know, another huge liability. Well, maybe for Tesla it's not material when you're losing $1 billion a quarter, but those are liabilities and they count.
Right.
These things are all, they're all ticking time bombs in there.
Right.
Plus you're turning out a car that's really got, you know, there's so much service center strain handling all these Model 3 issues right now. It's, you know, I happen to think that there's something wrong with the Tesla touchscreen. People are experiencing problems with that. Tesla's tried to solve the problem by having over-the-air updates that cool the car when you're not in it. That causes battery drain. Is it going to be sufficient when the sun starts shining? We'll see. how all that plays out.
You mean that there's something with the functionality of the touchscreen as it relates to the car being too hot?
Yeah, when there's a big temperature differential at the frame that holds that touchscreen, it's causing people to see funny things happening with their touchscreen. It's causing people to notice that their radio comes on when they're outside the car.
Right, yeah, I've heard that.
Wild things are happening. And I'm told that, you know, you read the forum boards, people are saying, well, Tesla just did an OTA that now cools my car and won't let it get hotter than 105 degrees. So even if I'm not in the car, the fan comes on. Well, so I woke up this morning and my battery was down 20%. I mean, what kind of a solution is that? And how well is that going to work when it becomes summertime in Arizona? I don't know.
But that's asinine.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see where all that goes. There's so many things that can go wrong, and everything has to go perfectly, and better than perfectly, for it to make sense for this company.
Yeah.
But as I said at the beginning, it's a religion, so maybe it doesn't matter.
Did you well, I guess I'll ask you one last question. We'll wrap it up. I know when I'm asked what I think the bull case is on Tesla, I really try to consider it. You know, I try to take the other side of how I'm thinking, and I try to take the best of the best in terms of arguments from any type of counterparty during any transaction. So I always want to know what the best on the other side has when I'm placing a trade or when I'm taking a side on something. So it's in my nature to kind of try to identify what the best case scenario is if I'm short something. And to me, what I really see the best case scenario being here is I think the stock falls precipitously and somebody buys them for the brand, or somebody buys them to own Musk. I don't think anybody's going to pay $50 billion or even $25 billion for the company. But I think if the company is valued at $10 billion or at $12 billion, I think that discussion starts to happen. And I really see that as the only bull case. I don't know. To me, there's nothing that's been put in front of me that makes me think like there is a bull case. And I guess as my last question, ask you, what do you think the best case scenario is? What's the bull case?
I have never read a persuasive bull case based on valuation. I mean, I think at one time there was a story to be told that Tesla was the pure EV play and the only pure EV play out there. And so maybe it made sense. But the performance of the company should lead. I see people struggle to come up with valuations for Tesla, and they quickly have to revise them and revise them repeatedly. So it's not based on valuation. The bull case is, I think, is the case that this is a religion. People are going to stay with it. They just believe in Elon Musk. And as long as he's able to issue equity, even though the company's worth far less, if you can just keep pumping dollars into it, eventually it will grow into the equity value. It may be bad for those investors. They may discover that they've all paid way too much because the company won't generate dividends ever that would justify it. But to me, that's the only hope. Short of that, who wants to take on, if you buy Tesla, are you going to take on the supercharger liabilities? Are you going to take on the warranty obligations? What are you going to do with all the outstanding claims for full self-driving? What are you going to do with all the autopilot liabilities? I mean, it's a bundle of liabilities. What are you going to do? Who pays the state of New York all the money it owes the state of New York? Who pays Nevada when Nevada starts clawing back, as it's going to be able to do in 2024? There's just a lot of reasons why anybody buying this company would want it to be washed first in a bankruptcy court.
Right.
That's what it seems like. A prepackaged bankruptcy is the best solution for reorganizing it.
Right. All right. You have anything else that you want to get down?
No, good, Chris. Enjoy chatting with you. It went on longer than I thought it would.
I knew it was going to, by the way. I told you when we started that it would.
Yep.
Once you got going. So.
All right. Listen, enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Take care.
All right. That was the one, the only Montana skeptic who came to us, I guess, live from a bunker in Montana. This was the QTR podcast, I think number 23. I better check that before I make it. I think it is. Yeah, this was QTR 23. And before we call it a night, I will, just one more time, let you know that this episode was brought to you by VPN.com. Do you use Facebook, Instagram, or WhatsApp? More than 2 billion people do. Unfortunately, the recent Cambridge Analytica data scandal has brought many issues to light about how Facebook uses your data and informs you when an issue arises. Since 2014, more than 2 billion Facebook profiles like yours and mine were scraped by third parties without our permission on Facebook and then maliciously used against us. Thankfully, there's many efforts out there taking a stand for our privacy and how big companies respect our data. Organizations like VPN.com have created campaigns entirely around hashtag #DeleteFacebook to bring awareness to the reality of how our data is being used. In fact, they sent 6 huge hashtag #DeleteFacebook box trucks to the U.S. Capitol and Facebook headquarters, along with arranging multiple protests to advocate for more privacy and protection for consumers all across the world. To learn more about how to delete your Facebook or to keep up with the protests, visit VPN.com/Facebook today. That was an entirely... that was a fantastic conversation with Montana Skeptic. It's one of the first times I've ever spoken to him. He comes off like an extremely educated and knowledgeable individual. Hopefully he will come on the podcast again, if it's not to talk about Tesla, then to talk about something else. But I was just reading his bio again on Seeking Alpha, and he manages, it looks like, a $1 billion portfolio according to his Seeking Alpha bio. But I can understand why. With a background in commercial litigation, I think he sees this very clearly, and I'm really glad that he came on. So I want to thank him again, even though he's not on the line anymore, and hopefully we will get to speak to him again in the future. But for now, we're going to call it a day. I hope you guys sincerely are having a fantastic Monday. It's beautiful here in Philadelphia, and you will be hearing from me this week. Got a lot of great guests lined up and may even come on and shriek into the microphone by myself at some point also. With that being said, I'm out of here. Peace.